Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my fan friends. Welcome to another Rahalastapa Book Club, in which we just discuss a book, because I want to try and read more books. This is a good, and you should read more books. And this is a good book to be discussing with that in mind. I'm joined once again by a man who's been on quite a lot of these Friday podcasts. It's Robin Ince. Hello, Robin. And we are discussing your very important work, The Importance of Being Interested, by Robin Ince, who is also the author of this, as well as talking about it. Thank you for coming in and chatting via Zoom. What is your book about, Robin? What would you say it's about?
Well, I suppose the basic idea of it was the more that I was doing science shows, the more I would come across people who were scared by certain kind of ideas of science, or just had that bit of existential anxiety. So whether that was about, you know, the size of the universe, the idea that everything is finite, our connection with all of the other living creatures in the world, all of these things which can kind of sometimes remove some of the certainties that make living, you know, possible for you. They're kind of coping mechanisms. You know, science can pull away quite a few of your coping mechanisms. So I wanted to write a book where I would kind of say, I know that this thing has been taken away from you by evidence and stuff, but there's another story in it as well, which is perhaps enriching. So it was to give, you know, some of it really came from the time, I suppose, one of the first ideas was when my son was about 7 or 8 years old, and he became aware of the idea that things might be finite. You know, that bit where you kind of go, oh, mum and dad might not be around forever. And in fact, I might not be around forever. And that, and the things that I told him to try and reassure him. So, but without recourse to things that I don't believe in, because I know some people said, do you know what, at a certain age just say there's a heaven or something like that, and I was like, well, I don't want to do that. So I told him some stories about the kind of just the the atoms that he was made of and where they'd been and where they might go. And that was one of the things I started to think more and more about. How can you find, because for me, I've generally found most of the scientific ideas that I've found out about in the last 20 years have been enriching and useful, not increased my existential anxiety, which already was high anyway. So, I mean, you know, I walked in with quite a lot of existential anxiety. Maybe it was at peak existential anxiety anyway. There was nowhere for it to go. And so that was really the starting point. And to kind of, and also the other thing was, a lot of people say, oh, I haven't really got a scientific brain, or I'm not into science. And that's another thing that I've come across a lot in the years that I've done science shows. So I wanted to say, oh, you don't need a special brain, and you don't have to worry about knowing what the equations mean, and you might not win the Nobel Prize, but there's lots to be gained by just beginning to look at the world from some of the ways that science looks at the world.
Yeah, well, it's very good for that. I listened to an audio book about, I think it's The God Particle. I've forgotten the name of the author, but it was all about quantum physics, and it was interesting, but it was just, a lot of it was way beyond what I could understand, even though it was still quite a simple book. And I suppose that is part of although there's still things in this book that kind of bend your mind a little bit, it's part of it is that the relationship you have on the Infinite Monkey Cage and with Brian Cox is that you're not coming from this, I know everything and I'm going to tell you now in confusing detail. It's sort of from a starting point. Well, interestingly that you were put off this stuff at school and, but have become interested in it off your own bat in your own way, I suppose, as well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it just felt like I was missing out on a lot. And again, I don't have any deep understanding. You know, quite often when I've been doing events about the book, so I'm going to put the hand up and say, just one of the things I wanted to ask about Heisenberg. And I go, oh, no, there's another man who does that work for me. This isn't my... So it's kind of... But I would always refer people... I mean, this was an interesting thing as well, which I think says a lot about... I think one of the reasons that people don't like science is you can be wrong in a way that you're not wrong when you have an opinion about some opera you've seen or whatever. And so I think even in kind of, you know, well, I say even, you know, sometimes especially in broadcasting companies or the BBC or whatever it will be, people love being, oh, I went to Covent Garden actually, saw La Traviata. And one of the things that I thought was particularly interesting about that interpretation, and something I was reading the other day about quantum mechanics, something that I would question about, and then if someone says, oh, that's not actually really how we look at wave-particle duality. Well, that seems rather insulting, actually, doesn't it? Because actually, my opinion on the Traviata, everyone thought was very, very good, so I don't see why I'm... And you see it in newspapers all the time, all these terrible, terrible hacks and provocateurs who never really understand the science and actually find it insulting that anyone should dare to say, you've misunderstood. Well, what do you mean I've misunderstood? I've actually got a 2-1 from Oxford in PPE. Well, you may well have that, but it doesn't. And, you know, we've seen that a lot during the COVID, you know, during the lockdown, where there's people who are very intelligent in one particular area. And then they've said, and this is why I don't believe vaccines work, because they think, you know, they've done their kind of YouTube stuff and they've read their things and they've not really understood what they've seen. And but they've thought, well, I've got my certificate on a wall, so it means I'm brainy and everything. And I think that is why once you accept, you go, all right, then this is really difficult, and a lot of it I'm never going to understand. And I have to accept that there are an enormous number of people who know more than me about these things.
Yeah, and you know, and they aren't the great thing about science, or the interesting thing about science, is they're not necessarily right. That something might come along and you know, and change their view. We even write at the end of the book, there's a bit where you go, oh, and I've just read another book that shows this thing I've just said isn't the case anymore. And so, you know, that you're open, being interested is about being open to new information, which, as you say about when you're talking about kids, that kids enjoy learning, and even if they have an idea about something, they'll go, I think eyes work like this by shining beams of light at stuff, and then you show them it doesn't, and then they're excited that they were wrong, and they're excited by the next piece of information.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Anna Goldsworthy, who was a teacher that I spoke to, and the only reason that she ended up kind of specialising and writing about how to teach science was because in her school, no one else at a primary school, no one else wanted to teach science because they were all petrified of being wrong. And they hadn't really enjoyed it, and that, and so she ended up by default. And then these lovely things that she does, or when they talk about digestion, and she goes, "Oh, so we got a load of old tights, and we stuffed some food in it, and then we kind of wrung it," and all of that. And that's what you see, that you're meant to get to a point where you no longer like just getting kind of mucky and sticking Mentos in a fizzy drink and seeing how they explode and stuff. And the truth of it is that people always still enjoy that. You should still yeah. enjoy, you know, dicking around. And yeah, that's something I wanted to get across in the book as well, is the amount of play that exists in science. I think very often in secondary school education, it can seem, due to the way the curriculum is, that it's just these, you know, kind of abstract numbers and symbols on a board. And you lose the bit of Einstein just daydreaming, just thinking about, if there was nothing around me and I was just falling, but there was no other reference, how would I know I was falling? And he starts, you know, all of those things, they start off with daydreaming and playing around.
Yeah, and the place of the imagination within science is, yeah, as you say, is often like forgotten. But obviously, theories come from just sort of partly from guessing and thinking maybe it's like this. Let's see if it's like this. Let's see if this is the reason this happens. And you know, there is a lot of fun in science. And I think you're right. The book sort of does sort of talk about school not necessarily nailing that aspect usually, or a lot of school not doing so. Did it come out of lockdown, this book, in that you, was it, because I thought it was going to be more like, oh, I've had conversations with lots of people, which it clearly is, and here they are written out. But actually, you've had hundreds of conversations with people and used tiny little snippets. It's not, you know, it's your book with tiny little quotes from these many conversations you've had, rather than here's a chapter where I talked to Brian Cox about this, or here's a chapter, you know. So it's, was it an idea you'd had before lockdown?
Yeah,
or was it,
I mean, I was. That's what I was going to spend last year, 2021, doing, was writing that book. That was my plan.
Right.
And that's right, isn't it? 2020. That was it. 2020 yeah. was when I started writing it. Yeah, right. That would be it. And it took a very long. It didn't take that long to write, but it took an enormous amount of time to edit. Because it was over 100,000 words longer than the publisher wanted, and eventually I cut out about 70,000. But I've never spent so long editing a book, and that was one of the interesting things. You know, I'd be talking to these astronauts, or I'd be talking to Jane Goodall, and then an editor would say, "You've just kind of put in everything that Jane Goodall said," and I said, "Yeah, of course I have. She's brilliant." And then because, it, as you say, it's not a book of interviews, there's lots of people weaved into it. That was why it became so enormous, because I wanted to have all of those bits in there, and I wanted to have so much of kind of, you know, talking to people like Rusty Schweikart from Apollo 9 and things like that. So that bit was very, very tough. But that's what did change the book as well, which was originally there weren't going to be so many people weaved through it. And then when lockdown began, one day I was thinking, oh, there's a thing I want to know about space travel. And, you know, fortunately, I have got the contact details of astronauts and stuff. So I sent an email to Chris Hadfield. I said, "Chris, you got an afternoon where you can just have a little chat?" It's just about half an hour or so. He said, "Yeah, sure." And so we had a long conversation. And that was the first interview. And then the next day I thought, yeah, I really do need to know this thing. And suddenly I knew that everyone was bored. Everyone was at home. Everyone was desperate to talk about what they did. And so that's why I ended up, I mean, I've got over 1 million words of interviews in files. So it's like, I think at the back where I thank people, there's probably more people thanked for doing an interview that didn't appear in the book than for, you know, there's a huge set of philosophers and, you know, Eric Idle, I had a chat with him because of course he had David McColman, because there was going to be, for some reason, there's going to be a chapter about music. So that all of these different people who aren't even in the book. And then someone said, "Well, that must be great. That means you've got another book there." I went, "No, for some reason, I don't know if you find this." You go, "Yeah, I have got 1 million words too many, but none of them are somehow of any use apart from in this book that I was writing."
Yeah, well, I think that's probably the correct call. Well, you might find one of the sparks of something else, I suppose. But yeah, it is. You know, it's a slight. I know you've got this butterfly brain anyway. And it's a slight. You know, we're jumping around lots of different subjects, but it does cover things very well and give you sort of current thought on most things. Yeah, I mean, there's loads of things I'm interested in. I'm interested in sort of the infinite universe idea, that if the universe is infinite, then everything happens, which I sort of feel there's a chance, even if the universe is infinite, that there isn't anywhere else where there's even human beings. I don't see why it has, there's, because, you know, there's lots of different kinds of infinity, and the chances of human beings even appearing on this planet took so many steps, you know what I mean? To get everything had to happen as it happened, basically, in the last billion years for human beings to arrive. That it makes me think, A, maybe human beings are the only intelligent beings in the universe, and B, you know, not everything that can happen happens. If you're saying the universe is infinite, so everything happens, A, people are twins and that aren't the same, so there could be the same connection of atoms as me and it's still not me. But B, is there a universe where I decide to conduct the rest of this conversation in Spanish, even though I can't speak Spanish and don't think you can, and I persist with that and carry on doing that? Do you think that happens if the universe is infinite?
Well, if it's infinite, yes.
I don't think I wouldn't ever do that. So it's not
is a better you. There is a you that is way more than bilingual.
There's a you where you're
Dr. Doolittle. You go to the zoo, no, you're chatting to some dolphins.
That's not what we're talking about.
Some pygmy shrews. You're having a wonderful time. You are probably one of the most limited Richard Herrings in the universe, which is a great pity.
There's a universe which is exactly the same up to the moment we started this interview, which it would have to be, Robin, for this interview to take place. And for us all to be here, in the cast of humanity and all the animals and all the bits of grass to be in all the same places. And then according to you, there's a universe where I, as me, at this moment, everything's exactly the same up to right now. Go, no, I'm going to give a crack and I'm only going to speak Spanish for the rest of my life. And I'm not going to attempt to learn Spanish.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen.
No, not in this universe. It's a limit of your imagination. I mean, there is a possibility that even in infinity, some kind of intelligence has said just one herring will do. I know everything else has an infinite number of versions, but he's nothing but more than problematic. But it is, I think that infinity is a good example of something which is we cannot really get our head round it. Because we can't even really get our head round. Once you go back more than 10,000 years, it's too big. Numbers become too... You know, I was reading a book by Jan Levin the other day, and, you know, just it's that lovely thing where you go, even between 0 and 1, there are an infinite number of numbers. So even there, an infinite number of fractions, right? So we find all these different ways of trying to frame it. But in the end, we're still not saying that if it was infinite, that is, it's a bit like, you know, the Boltzmann brain thing, which I think made it into the edit, but I can't entirely remember if I cut that out. But Boltzmann brain is the idea that it could look statistically more likely that what is happening at this very second is that you are basically, very briefly, a bunch of particles have come into a pattern that has created you believing you're experiencing this now, you believing that you've had a past for the last 53 years, you believing you'll have a future and all of those things. And that's all it is. All of that thing is just very briefly in the huge, vast sea of particles over a vast period of time, it's more likely than you actually existing. Now, that was actually originally, and like many things like Schrodinger's cat, it was actually originally come up with to say what a ridiculous idea that was. But nevertheless, it is still, there is a truth to it, that in an infinite universe with an enormous amount of time, then every now and again, it will just happen that a sea of particles come together in basically the pattern and the experience of a brain. And then they drift off again and then they become a bunch of flowers.
I disagree. That's the case, and I will not allow anyone to say. I think
you could refute it thus by kicking your desk, but that's a totally different argument.
There's so many infinite. You don't need to. You know, there's lots of different types of infinity, so you can have infinity versions of the universe where, you know, I'm the only Richard Herring, and, you know, that could be the case. And also the other Richard Herrings, I might not be the same. I might not have my fantastic soul inside them.
See, now I want the Christopher Nolan movie where in the steps that I see behind you, 27 Richard Herrings come up, all of them singing in Spanish. And you go, I've been a fool to reject this science.
But things have to. So, you know, there's no universe where I'm your dad, because that's not possible.
Well,
it's not possible that my genetics would create your genetics. So for you to exist, your parents are at least beings with the exact
but
same...
But it's just too many variables for us to be able to put it in our heads. That's basically the idea. Infinity is just too big. And the most important thing, you know, and I mentioned it quite a few times in the book, is sometimes these ideas are beautiful and wonderful and philosophically interesting, but don't base your life on them. You know, even if we are in a simulation, and I don't believe that we are in a simulation, and I believe even if we were in a simulation, it would make no difference the way you should live your life anyway, and what would happen in your life. Even if that's exactly, you just have to not, you know, go, that's a beautiful idea, that's perfect for the science fiction novel that I'm writing. But I've still got to basically worry about the fact that energy bills have really gone up, haven't they? And, oh, God, I forgot to buy eggs. Those are still bigger issues.
We are probably in a simulation, though.
Well, this is. I mean, I think that is far more likely, because I think coders would be malevolent enough to make us.
Yeah. I think, but, the, you know, again, it's sort of the chances of being alive right now and being in the lucky position we are to spend most of our life podcasting with each other, it's so unlikely to, in all of the world's 3.5 billion years, to be living right now and have the luck that we've had. It seems too good to be true. So a simulation makes more sense than just imagining it all. Kind of
I like the fact that you are both being Panglossian and then placing your glasses on your nose as well, which, and your nose, it works so well to fit your glasses as well, Dr. Pangloss.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But there's what I love about this book is the again, you get more range of source material, I think, than you would in a lot of science books. So you sort of talk about The Simpsons and Waiting for Godot and The Far Side and Keats and different... Eric von Daniken, I'm very glad, gets a... which, again, I think, like, Eric von Daniken's a very interesting thing in terms of... And especially now, isn't it, in terms of conspiracy theories and people filling in their own gaps to create their own stupid ideas like I just did about Infinite Universe. it's... But in a way... I was so obsessed with Eric von Daniken for a short period when I was sort of 13 or 14, but it does at least ignite your interest. And it sounds like you are as well, that you buy all these books.
Well, we're pretty similar generation. I think what you're about a year older than me. Which was our journey into some of these things was through when you're a kid, there's loads of brilliant nonsense and you don't know it's nonsense. And if you're lucky, you whittle it down in a less bad direction than other. I won't say a better, but a less bad direction. So, you know, all of those books about mysterious worlds and Atlantis and Eric von Daniken. And then that's kind of that nice bit that where you start. Or who was that guy? Used to write the thing of Don Juan. There was a Carlos Castaneda. Yeah, I don't know if you remember him, and so much of that stuff. It was, I mean, as I say in the book, one of the great examples, the thing you do learn from Eric von Daniken, is it's probably more profitable to write utter bullshit, because utter bullshit is always wrong. So his books are all still published, whereas most science books from the 60s and the 70s from the same period would no longer be published because the science has changed. because they're evidence-based. But if you're basing it on absolute just bollocks, then it remains absolute bollocks. And that's... I mean, I am sad about the fact that when I first started writing this book, there was this plan that in Blackpool they were going to build an Eric von Daniken world. It was kind of going to be part of... I don't know where... And then by the time I'd finished writing the book, that had been changed. So I can't even remember if I kept it in and just left the footnote or just had to scrub it out, which is a great pity. But, no, but that's the thing. Critical thinking is...
If the universe is infinite, it's still there somewhere. There's an infinite number of them, so don't worry, it'll be fine. You can go on a different universe. But yeah, that's all. And I think it is about that. Because you talk about Keats and science unweaving the rainbow, and this is a very passionate book in terms of saying that science makes, you know, in a lot of ways makes things more beautiful and better, and that truth is better than sort of lies and made up stuff. So I mean, looking at there's a good great chapter about death and the realities of death and how it isn't necessarily a bad thing to die. You know, I did a show called Rich Herring. What was it called? It was called something about being dead. I can't remember what it was called. That's terrible, isn't it? I can't remember my own shows. But it was about death, and it's that idea of actually never dying is sort of worse than having an end to your existence.
Yeah, eternity is too long, you know, that is. Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, the death chapter where I spoke to my friend John, who lost his son Jamie in he died in a motorcycle accident, and he was a very, you know, really, he's always been an interesting person to talk to about that. And because he's an atheist and most of his close family are atheists, and Jamie was an atheist, he didn't believe in any form of afterlife, but they've still found these ways of creating stories. And I think that's one of those things that I look as I was finishing the book, I thought, maybe this, you know, that bit where you go, maybe this is what the book should have been about. It's too late now. But about that importance of creating stories. And it's really, you know, after Jamie died, I can't remember which ones I mentioned in the book, but, you know, John would tell me these stories of, you know, that they always return to the nearest drainage grate where the accident happened, where Jamie died. They pour some bottles of J2O down the drainage grate. And the reason they do this ceremony is because when Jamie was a teenager, he drank loads of J2O thinking he was alcoholic and then weaved around the house going, "Oh, Dad, I've had loads of J2O. I'm really drunk." and finding that. And that's also what I wanted, because I think sometimes in some scientists and some science books can be very cold in just saying, well, there is no afterlife, there's no this and that. Finding, you know, that's one of the reasons I did a chapter about God, about the fact that there are some scientists I know who find a space to believe in some form of God and are also brilliant scientists. And, you know, I'd love to have examined more that idea of where God is in our brains compared to where evidence-based thinking is, because I think they are in kind of, without wishing to compartmentalize, but they can be in separate places. And so, yeah, I wanted to kind of put in a lot of stuff like that as well, which is you don't have to lose all your myths. You don't have to lose all your stories. Everything doesn't have to become an equation. You can still play around with a lot of ideas. You know, you play around with the memory of the people who are gone. You create your own. I mean, in fact, there's a really great, I've got it, Brian Greene's book, Until the End of Time. And he's a brilliant scientist. I love Brian Greene. And that was a really good book of looking at also how to make sure that the struggle to be human is still part of when we're looking at the scientific world, and to not immediately go, well, science says this, therefore you're not allowed to have that. Well, there might be a way that science says that and you can still have this thing. You can still have a little bit of this kind of, you know, magical dreaming.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose what's amazing about you, one of the many things that's amazing about you, Robin, is just the sheer volume of material that you've managed to ingest into your brain, and even just in terms of writing a book like this, managed to organise it into something that's coherent. But how do you find the time to read? So, you know, you read so much. How many books do you read a week? Do you read a book a day? Do you read a
I was explaining this to someone, and it's a thing that shocks and horrifies people sometimes when you do gigs in bookshops, is I don't finish a lot of books. I dive in all the time, you know, as you know, in the room that I'm in, it's just filled with books. It's ridiculous. And and I'll go, like the book that I'm working on now, I'll just suddenly go, where's that one? Where's that one? Right, there's that. And that leads to that, and that leads to that. So the hardest bit is, as you were saying there, is corralling it into a pattern that other people can understand. Like, quite often the first draft of a book, like with this one, which I haven't done with the most recent book, the book I've just written, I've done four drafts before I've shown it to anyone. But with this, right at the beginning, I started showing people drafts, saying what hits you, what works, what doesn't. And a lot of people, of my friends, always like the first draft most. But that's only because they know me and they can hear me going, Einstein and then Marie Curie and the thing about the episode of The Simpsons. Blah, 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 and they hear that and it's fine. But to anyone who'd pick that up in a bookshop would just go, someone's been sick all over this book.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's good. You know, it's good. I do want to read more. I mean, I find the audiobook of this book is great. I think my problem I have with audiobooks, and again, the problem with listening to the audiobook version of this is there's so many thoughts that then as you're listening, a thought springs off yourself. You know, so you'll say something that inspires. If you're reading the book, you can put the book down and have a think about it. But if you're listening to the book, you often find, oh, I'm 5 minutes on and I've been off on my own little journey. But in a way, this is the ideal book for that to happen with, because it's sort of the nature of the book itself.
That's what I really wanted to do. Was I was explaining to someone a while ago about roughly, you know, I could call it a process, but other people would just call it an illness, which is I just want to pour in as much as possible into my head and then shake it around and then take the top off. And that's kind of what my stand-up is. And I think, you know, what I mean, the book that I've just done, Bibliomaniac, which is a kind of about a love of books, and it goes off in so many different ways. It allowed me, it's based on the 100 bookshop tour that I did initially, but it allows me to explore in quite an erratic way loads of different books and loads of different ideas, because I'll get to a certain town and go, I remember this was where M.R. James was buried, and this leads to this thing, and then this leads to this ghost guy that I met, and then that leads to an idea about entropy, and then there was a bit where in the first edit where I'd suddenly go, ah, that's the one tangent too far. You know, where you can go, even with tangents, you can go, there's still a shape to them, and then you go, and now chaos. And that's kind of, you know, and that was the same with this book, which was, you know, I really wanted it to be dense with entertaining stories and interesting ideas, so that people would then go off and read proper books about these subjects. I mean, it's what Monkey Cage, what we always try and do as well, is never just go, here are some facts, but hopefully tell a story that's interesting enough that people then go, ah, I want to go off and find out more. I'm going to go now and buy a book or buy a telescope, whatever it is.
And so from a kind of a different perspective in the terms of writing, are you now at the stage where if you have an idea for a book, you can go to your publisher and your publisher will go, yep, go ahead? Or, I mean, is it sort of, are you presumably selling enough books that they keep coming back and say, do another one?
Well, let's find out after the next one. I mean, I was glad with, like, the Bibliomaniac one just came from the fact that in December, some people were saying, oh, I'm enjoying reading your blogs about going on the book tour. Why don't you do a book? And I suddenly went, it wouldn't surprise me if next year tours might still get cancelled. I'm really going to need something to do. So I wrote the first chapter. Yeah. And it was like, it's that difficult thing where I worry about purpose a lot. Like, this book had purpose in my mind. There was a specific reason for it to exist. And the previous one, I'm a Joke and So Are You, there was specific reasons, that stories that I wanted to tell that I thought could be helpful. And then working on this one is the first one that I've done for a while anyway, where I just go, I just want people to have fun with it and really enjoy it. Yeah. And there's no other purpose. And then I feel very guilty. But yeah, we'll find out when I'm about to finish this one now, do the final draft on that, and then we'll see if any publisher picks up on the next one that I've got, and then I'll be able to tell you if there's beginning to be a pattern.
Well, you're a joke's one. I mean, I mention it a lot in my podcast talking to other comedians, because I think there's sort of so much about why people become comedians, and I'm as fascinated about that as you. And I don't think I have any of the tragic stories in my life that have made me become a comedian that you talk about, but that's another fantastic book.
I'd really like to I wish it had been a huge success, because then I'd be allowed to just write a kind of, you know, a rewrite of it, because they say, oh yeah, you can do an update. And but that's the one that I would really like to, because I found out after doing that, we might have talked about this, I can't remember when we talked about it, you know, a couple of years ago, but it's the one that I've had the most people coming up and saying, like, even I was in FOP and in London, and this guy came up to me and said, can I just say this book, it really helped me with this thing. And, you know, people who've had issues and people who sometimes, you know, and that bit of, because we're all just seeking purpose, aren't we? And that bit of actually going, oh good, someone read this and they were in a really bad place, and somehow it jilted, you know, and that's what I mean. That's what we hope we do with stand up as well, isn't it? Which is that's why, you know, the really nasty, edgy stand up. I always think, I think stand up is at its best when you just go, oh, some people came tonight and they were all happier at the end and they felt that the world was a good place to live, you know.
Yeah. It's nice. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of, but it's sort of interesting in terms of, I mean, would you, as a writer, would you rather that, you know, your next book definitely happen? I mean, this is a sort of silly question because the other side, it would definitely happen. I mean, Adam Kay is that example where he writes a book and it suddenly goes insane and he can buy a massive mansion in the countryside as a result of writing one book. I mean, would you like that to happen to your books, or do you think it's sort of nice that you've got like a readership that a strong readership who will presumably buy everything you do and probably that will allow you to carry on writing more books? Or do you sort of covet that idea of this is the one that's going to break through and earn me millions of pounds?
The millions of pounds doesn't matter. But I'd like, it's that thing, I'm sure you've had it, where you go, if I just knew for sure that in every art centre I played, there weren't those towns where I have to keep tweeting, just so you know, still a few tickets there. It's literally that thing. It's not saying I want to play the arena. It's saying I would like to not be as worried about every small theatre. And I think what I would like is that I would like to, I mean, you know, I'm always filled with self-doubt and worry and stuff like that. And that's all. But I'm, you know, Adam Kay's. But I mean, the interesting thing about Adam Kay's, but even though that was enormous, it also, I think, had an incredible reach in terms of how it helped people. And that was a huge audience who, you know, and I've seen him talk about it live and I've seen the reaction that people, you know, had to him talking about that. So, yeah, obviously, I would like to have that. It's not, I'm not going to go, do you know what, Richard? What I'm really hoping is they never sell too well. I'm always hoping the publisher's just on a knife edge. I'd love the next one to, you know, I would love that. I mean, this one sold well. It's done absolutely fine. And but there's always a bit where you go, wouldn't it be lovely to, on almost every train that you sat on, just look across and go, maybe I'll go over and go, I hope you're enjoying my book, you know, that kind of. And I hope more people, I mean, I hope it keeps building. That's the thing, is each book sold more than the last one. And I'd like to, but yeah, I don't think I'd ever, I'm not worried about being, huge. I think we're in our 50s now. You need to, you just need to worry about creating stuff and going, oh, the stuff I've created has also led to being able to survive and being able to live. Yeah. You know, we're lucky, we lived quite nice lives, don't we?
We do. But it's such a precarious job being a writer. And that, you know, and I feel like we're probably in a similar position. Whereas if I come up with an idea, I've got a good chance of someone publishing it, but also not a very good chance of maybe it can, tens of thousands of people might buy it, or several thousand people might buy it, so it's not a disaster. But you know, it is nice to be in that position that you think, oh, I could spend the year writing a book and they'd probably pay me enough to, you know, with the other stuff I do, to make that worth doing. And
oh, I mean, that would be amazing if you actually went, oh my God, the advance I've got is so much that I'm not going to think about. But I mean, it's been lovely watching someone like Natalie Haynes, you know, and her stand up for the classics world. And, you know, each book has sold more than the last. And because when people have been introduced to a new book, they've gone back, they've bought her previous books, and you just see a career that has now reached a point in terms of, in, you know, her, the respect people have for her and things like that. Though I'm not worried about respect, I have to admit that bit. Where I still feel like an alien at almost every book festival that I go to, all the kind of highfalutin ones. I still feel like, what's it? But then again, I feel like that about comedy. You know, last night I went on at the end of a new act competition, and they were all great. And I said to them, just so you know, I'm, you know, 30 years I've been doing this, and I'm still going, oh God, I don't let down all the, you know, that bit. That fear of being an imposter, that fear of failure, much as I would like to have less of it, I do also realise it's what is perpetually driving me to go, I've got to come up with a new thing.
But I think, you know, you are, you know, this book is sort of almost your, just the title of it is sort of your philosophy, and the fact that you are interested in so many things and want to get to the bottom of them, but also that you're meeting, through your job, you're meeting all these extraordinary people that most people wouldn't get to meet and talk to and see the human side of. So, you know, I think you're exactly the right person to be put in that position, in that you're interested in the science, but you're also interested in people, and that's what comes out, I think, from this, is you're talking to astronauts and maybe asking them questions that another astronaut wouldn't ask them and a scientist might not ask them, but that will humanize the situation, because it's sort of, certainly with physicists and things like that, it's kind of, they seem so, I mean, I love that stuff about David Deal, that he's obviously done that play about it, but that quantum physics feels like it's so fanciful what you're being told, that it could just be the same thing as an oracle on a Greek mountain spouting a load of shit at you and saying, yeah, you're actually just a, you know, you're a shadow of something from the 12th dimension that, and you don't exist in any way, you're just a projection. And there, you know, it's very hard to kind of understand. I mean, you do a pretty good job with this, but I still don't. I still can't understand that those ideas, those quantum ideas of.
But I don't think it is necessarily about understanding.
No.
I think there's a level of understanding that even comes from just realizing how utterly baffling it is. The baffling nature of reality, solidity, all of those things. That's already a start of understanding. The bit where there's no understanding is when someone lives in a certain world. And, of course, there's loads of those people. And sadly, they're the ones who are able to monetize their ridiculous opinions best, because people like that bit of once you go, oh, accept that you're never really going to understand it, and accept that in some ways, whatever you're trying to understand, there's no point in you, because you're not going to be the person who invents the thing that's useful. That's not the area you're in. So it doesn't matter. But the bit that you just go to find that bafflement, something which has a kind of delight in it, a sensation, rather than merely, oh, God, this is baffling. Two-dimensional hologram. As I mentioned in the book, you know, it's that David Lynch thing. You know, I love films that don't make direct sense. I like them a lot more than a film that goes, hi, my name's Mike Goody. I'm Tony Baddy. And you watch that and you go, yeah, here we go. Here's their three acts. And then I watch someone like David Lynch. And again, that's why I bring up Beckett and, you know, Tarkovsky and people like that, is you can watch them and you can get different things from them. And if one person says, well, I can tell you exactly what it means, when the director can't tell you exactly what it means, then you know that they're bullshitting. Yeah. And I think it would be very pleasing if we could get more people, just because, I mean, all the people that I played to when I did the bookshop tour, they were so lovely. And I mean, the loveliest thing is when I'd sometimes do, like in Wivenhoe, where I went to a lovely bookshop in Wivenhoe, and it was a Saturday afternoon audience, you know, predominantly retired people, very excited to hear, oh, now that's very, so tell me again, the extraterrestrial, you know, and these are all new ideas to people. And then I had this lovely, there was a 90-year-old woman who was in the front row of an event I did in Berkhamsted, and she was like, it was as if she was conducting what I was saying, because I could watch her different quizzical reactions as I was talking, and it was almost like she was kind of go over there. And at the end of it, she said, I'm 90 years old, and I wasn't allowed to study science. I had to study three dead languages, and then they made me go and work in the diplomatic community, and I did not enjoy it at all. And now I'm 90, and I can like science as much as I want, and I do. And it was just like these things. It's just like, and I loved, again, all of those curious people, and none of them are curious going, you know, I think I'm probably now going to end up inventing something. They're just enjoying the bit that every time you find out an interesting new idea, it changes your perspective, and therefore it gives you more views. You know, a single window that you're looking out of has just an enormous number of different views if you keep changing your knowledge of the sky.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's, okay, I mean, that's sort of interesting, isn't it? To think you and I might have 30 or 40 more years where we can just keep ingesting stuff and trying to make sense of it. And it is. And then ultimately, you know, Robin Ince, all this information in him will just disappear and everything will turn to mulch and all the things you've experienced.
Except we'll leave our books behind and people will learn about penises and testicles from your work, Richard.
There'll always be penises and testicles. That's not going to change. I've chosen the right.
Well, it's a lovely thing, isn't it? Because that's the bit. We leave these things, these mind fossils behind, and they'll go, the mind fossils left here are from Robin Ince are about giant killer crabs and about astronauts and about mental health. And it's all cocks and balls from...
It's all for... Well, I was thinking, as I was written, one of the ideas that sparked off me, which, again, it sort of just came tangentially from your book, and I can't even quite remember which bit it was the idea... I just thought it'd be weird if one person's phone survived 10,000 years and they could get the battery working, then they could read all the data on it, and that was the only survival from the civilization. And if it was your phone, or not your phone, but if it was one's phone, that would be all the works of literature and whatever that survived. And just thinking, God, all the podcasts and all the crap that's on your phone and all the things that aren't on your phone. If your device became the library for which, you know, our entire civilization's work was
well,
remembered.
It would be beautiful, wouldn't it, to go, so what was this 21st century civilization? It was predominantly the worship of departed testicles, because they'll see that lovely puppet work you do, and they'll just go, yeah, there was, so this was their god. Yes, this was their god.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's so interesting how, you know, but it is all those different perspectives coming together and different tastes. And yeah, it is, it's amazing when, you know, I think it's amazing when you can read plays from ancient Greece, or, you know, you get, but even getting audiobooks from people who have died, and there is this element that your life does go on a little bit through your work, which is you know, something you sort of discuss a little bit in the book as well. But anyway, look, there's so much stuff in there. There's time travel, very interesting. The experience of astronauts, death, simulations, infinite universes, as we discussed. There's so many things discussed in this. It's absolutely, if you're at all interested in science and at all curious and interested, then this is a fantastic book to buy. So please buy it, people. If we do this book club, it will be, if you buy all Robin's book and then Robin's publisher sees, hey, why did we suddenly sell 400 copies of this book on this day? Okay, it was Richard Herring, and then we'll get some decent authors on, not just my I'm joking. We will. It's fantastic. Thank you very much. Why should people buy your book, Robin? Let's do that. They should do.
Because hopefully it will just give them. I mean, the subtitle is Adventures in Curiosity, and that's genuine. I wanted to have people to have as many adventures as possible. And it's like I was saying, it's that thing where I think if you just keep filling up your head with new stuff, It makes time move a bit slower, because the more novelty that you're dealing with. So if you're worried about the brevity of your life, reading books like mine will make, oh no, that sounds like it's a boring book. That's why it's going to feel like it's longer. It's not because it's a boring book, but because it's filled with lots of new things.
Yeah.
Also, a lot of people buy, I found that was like in November, no, it was in October, lots of people were buying it for their kids who had just gone to university to study science, because they thought, oh my God, they're going to get bored of science. And this frivolous, foolish man might somehow still find something captivating in it.
I do think it's very, I mean, probably for teenagers and above, because it's quite complicated, but it's,
the youngest reader that I've heard from so far was 12, and the oldest one was 93.
Okay.
I got this message. It was someone when I was down in Totnes, beautiful bookshop in Totnes, and this person said, "Oh, my 93-year-old granddad couldn't come along. He wanted to come along, but can you sign this book for him?" And then I got a message a month later, and she went, "My granddad's read your book, and he said this is the book I've been waiting for my whole life." And to get that from a 93-year-old, you go, "That's all right then. That's, you know, I might not sell millions of books, but to get a reaction like that makes me quite happy."
That's got to go on the front cover. Thank you very much, Robin.
Thank you, Richard Herring.
We'll be back with more of these, you know, intermittently. They're not necessarily going to be every week.
Well, every time someone who's a friend of yours has written a book, because as you said, no one else is. That's a no from Margaret Atwood. Bloody hell.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.